There was a really great question in our last episode, Helen. If soil keeps building up to cover buildings and things like that, is the world getting bigger? And I can't stop thinking about it. So is it?
No, Martin, it's not. But it is getting hotter. You know, there are some things we need to worry about, but not that the world is getting bigger, no.
Okay, well, we're clear on that. Let's get started on the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome to another episode, and thank you so much for the lovely comments we had about our previous one, which we recorded on our dig at Norton Disney in Lincolnshire. We had great fun, didn't we, Martin?
Oh, we did. It was so much fun. There in the data dome surrounded by trenches, the test pits. If you haven't listened to that episode, do go and do it now. We also had huge quantities of cake, which I think I'm still recovering from, but there we go. Anyway, speaking of digs, Time Team's recently announced some very exciting news, hasn't it?
Yes. Now we're going back to Sutton Hoo in May and June next year. So it's a little bit earlier in the year than we went this year, so as to take in the school half term. So we're hoping for even more people to come down and see what we're doing. And last year was a great success. We established the depth and the condition of what was there. And we had the amazing luck to find the rest of that Byzantine bucket, part of which had been found in 1986. And to our surprise, that seems to have been within the cremation cemetery that we suspected was going to be in the trench. And in fact, it might have been used as a container for cremated bone. It's all very exciting what's happening there with the bucket. But next year, with that experience that's under our belt, we're going to have a really careful look at some of those geophysical blobs, those geophysical anomalies, that I hope three of them at least, and also at least part of a ring ditch, which could be Bronze Age or it could be Anglo-Saxon. So that trench, next year's trench, is going to be an extension of 2024's, of this year's, but at right angles to it. So it takes us in a different direction. But having said that, Martin, our planning meeting to start thrashing out exactly what we're going to do hasn't actually happened yet. It's in a couple of weeks. So don't hold me to any of those details. It may all change. I mean, apart from the time, it will definitely be second half of May, first half of June. So if you're in the area, do come along.
Yeah, please do. And don't forget, you will be able to follow it all here on the Time Team podcast and across Time Team on YouTube and Patreon and all that sort of stuff. Speaking of the bucket, by the way, Helen, have we got much further with that?
Well, yes. Now, the last we saw of it, it was wrapped up in bandages, damp, wrapped up in bandages, covered in cling film, and it's had a little travel up for a little holiday in Yorkshire. Naomi has sorted out this amazing top-notch scanning at Bradford University. They've got really big X-ray and CT scanning machines. So they're putting it through with lots of kind of experimental, different exposures, different angles and so on and so forth, so that we get some more detail on what to expect inside the bucket, which eventually is going to be transferred over to York, where it's going to be excavated in the lab by Jackie McKinley and also by a conservator. They're going to go together so that Jackie gets absolutely every little bit of knowledge about any cremated bone that's inside, but also so that the conservator can make sure it's all stuck back together again and stabilised as we go down. Because, of course, as we empty it, all its support of sand is going to leave it, and we've got to make sure that it doesn't fall to bits, to put it frankly.
Such a delicate process as well. And it's great to see all of the Time Team family seeming to want to, and indeed are, they're all getting their mitts on it, aren't they, to do their various different stages of that project that they need to do to get the archaeology out of it. And of course, as time goes on, we'll learn even more details, as I mentioned, on Time Team social media and on the YouTube channel as well. We were, of course, at Sutton Hoo for the first time back in June. June. And while we were there, Helen and I got the chance to speak to Professor Martin Carver.
Yes, now Martin Carver was the archaeologist who won the design competition back, it must have been in the very early 1980s, because he started that next lot of excavations at Sutton Hoo in 1982, 1983, which ran on for 10 years. That was where I had my first proper digging experience, where Martin was the man who taught me how to, particularly taught me my lovely shovelling technique. I'm very proud of my shovelling technique. and so we caught up with him on the sidelines of the main trench at Sutton Hoo back in June, and he told us why Sutton Hoo's such an important site.
I think it's so important now because of the quality of the material that was dug out of a ship in 1939, and it had a priceless collection of jewellery, which is now in the British Museum. Amazing craftsmanship at a time when this craftsmanship was really revolutionary. So that's why they love it now. If you're saying why was it important in the past, it's because we don't have that many cemeteries which of this quality. The early 7th century is a pivotal moment. It's between tribal and kingdom. It's between pagan and Christian. It's a time when the people of East Anglia were looking to the past. They were, so to speak, looking at the prehistoric mounds and burying in them. And they were looking across the channel to the continent and even to the Mediterranean. So it's a really important period, and we're very lucky to have any knowledge of it. But this is particularly fine.
And it has got a kind of transitional importance as well, not just for today and the future, and not just in the past in the 7th century, but in 1939, the Anglo-Saxon period really was thought of as the Dark Ages, of people essentially living in holes in the ground because there's been a misunderstanding of building types. But Sutton Hoo changed all that, didn't it?
I think it's very important what you're saying, and I think it's very important to realise that time moves on. So there isn't an Anglo-Saxon period, really. There is a long period between the leaving of the Romans and the coming of the Normans, where an enormous amount happens.
Fast forward then to your involvement with Sutton Hoo. Why did you think it was important to come back to this site?
Well, why was a ship buried with all that treasure at Sutton Hoo in the early 7th century? This is the why that, why there, why then question. They didn't have an answer to that. The whole thing was like a phenomenon. And as a phenomenon, historians don't like phenomena, really. They like to know what's going on. And so they wanted to go back and have a look. The assumption was that they dig all the rest of the mounds. So they put an advertisement in the London Gazette. We need a director for this. We're going to go back to Sutton. We're going to dig and find out the answer to the question, well, what was that doing there? Put your application in. So you asked me why I was interested. Well, I was interested because I was a commercial archaeologist doing lots of digging for money. And I could immediately see we were a bit handicapped. The point is, we were only working with two factors. One was how long we could take and the tools that we had. I had to demonstrate to people that there was another way of doing this. I said we would need 2 years to decide what to do. And then after that, we need a fixed period to do it. And the concomitant is we will not dig the whole site. Well, as nearly everybody else who applied for the job said, we must dig the whole site or we'll never understand what's there.
It was the era of total excavation, where famously somebody said the only relevant question is, what is there there? And the difficult thing is that if you are only asked that very broad question, you won't really get any very precise answers. And Martin's design had questions that could be answered. You know, we want to know this. We'll find it out using that piece of evidence, and then we'll be able to tell the story.
We put together a project which did not dig the whole site, and that was trying to address the question, not just what burials are there, but in which order were they dug?
That's Martin Carver speaking to us at Sutton Hoo back in June. And we had a really wide-ranging interview with Martin, who went into great detail about the work they did in the 80s, why Sutton Hoo's such an important place, and why it still has lots of secrets to share. And we're going to put the whole interview up on Patreon, the whole thing in its entirety. So if you're one of our supporters, you'll be able to hear loads more from Martin. And that interview that was recorded at Sutton Hoo should get you in the mood for Time Team's return there next year.
This is the Time Team Podcast. Now, over the last two episodes, you've been hearing me try to learn what it takes to be a landscape archaeologist, and I've been doing it with Time Team's Stuart Ainsworth. I visited him at his base at the University of Chester, where he taught me how to read maps like an archaeologist, how to interpret LiDAR data, and then how to apply that to a real-world scenario.
Yes, you've been out in a field, haven't you, Martin? Lying flat on your front, if I remember, to examine
yes,
a Viking defensive earthwork. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's time for Martin to put all the new skills he's acquired to the test now, because that field near Chester has one final secret to divulge.
Yet again, Stuart, I'm trudging through a bog. I seem to be doing a lot of this with you, because we're here to talk about landscape archaeology.
It's trying to tell the story of the landscape that you're standing on now through time. Landscape is a mixture of lots of components, physical, climatic, and social.
You arrive here then, in this field. What's catching your eye as a landscape archaeologist?
First thing I tend to default to is the geology, because that was here before we were. The landforms were created millions and millions of years ago. I'm standing here at the moment, a river over my left shoulder, there's bits of woodland. I'm trying to piece together what that might be telling me in its own right. The reality of the ground, you're trying to unlock that story. And you use as much evidence as you can to do it. Something can look really, really interesting on the LiDAR, but when you get there, it's obvious it was created about 50 years ago.
You and I have discussed the medieval things that were happening in this field. We've discussed a Viking defence, but those are just two periods in history. This has got such a story to tell.
We've got evidence of continuous occupation right from prehistory right through to the present day. So a chunk of ground like this cannot have episodes where nothing actually happens. As we're talking, there's a cluster of different vegetation over there and some lumpy, bumpy stuff. Immediately, I would want to go and look at that.
Well, let's go. Let's go and have a look at it. This is the exciting bit, actually getting to go and see the features that you can just look at on a screen in real life.
Well, this is where I quite like having the sheep and cows to talk to, actually, because I'm interrogating these lumps and bumps, and I'm articulating some things which, well, no, it can't be that. Can't
can
be
I
this,
articulate something? This is a really big hole.
Well, I didn't really want to describe it as that, but you're absolutely right.
There's a massive hole.
That's the first, again, that's part of the process. It's a hole. Let's walk around it, Martin. It's probably 3-4 metres deep.
Yeah, yeah, and pretty wide as well. What, 10-15 metres wide?
Yeah.
It looks like some sort of crater. Circular, maybe slightly oval in shape.
That's a perfect description of it. It's a crater-shaped, roughly circular hole. It's clear that this is later than these medieval plough ridges, because it cuts through them. The ridge is on that side, the ridge is on this side, we're standing on the edge of it. This crater has cut straight through them. So what does that tell you?
That it was here afterwards.
It's later than the medieval period. Then you start comparing, as a landscape archaeologist, you then start comparing it with other things that you know about. What this is very typical of, and I've seen lots of them, is a bomb crater.
Right, yeah, it does look like that. Is bomb or meteorite?
Well, on the balance of probability, I'd go for bomb rather than meteorite. But yeah, that's the same logic. Something has hit the ground very hard. And I know that this was a bomb that was dropped in the Second World War by a German aircraft which was bombing Liverpool at the time. It dropped some of its bombs simply to lighten its load so it could escape. It was being chased by a night fighter, and those bombs dropped in this field. And what the earthworks here are telling me is that the plane must have been flying in this direction, because
over our heads,
because the material from the crater has all gone in one direction.
It shot that way, and that's why the bank is on that side, not this side.
Exactly. So you can even work out which direction the aircraft was flying from the earthworks. How about that for a strange landscape connection? These two bomb craters here that fell serendipitously in this field were looked at next day, because they were quite exciting for lots of school children and so on. The local school came out with their master, and found lots of Roman artifacts, which revealed a Roman settlement.
And that just shows that there really is everything going on in this field from right across history.
All in a very, very small area. It's a wonderful way to spend a couple of hours. You know, we've been out working together today. You're out in the fresh air, you're looking at the ground, you're reading its story, its narrative. And in reality, anybody can do that. That is the wonderful thing about landscape archaeology, because it translates everywhere from academic research and investigation to enjoying a walk through the countryside.
Well, thank you for showing me it. Let's carry on our walk.
That is an extraordinary story of a Roman site being discovered by Second World War bombs. And it sounds like you had a great day out with Stuart.
I had a fantastic day out with Stuart, and I learnt loads as well. A massive thank you from me to Stuart, who was just so gracious with his time. And he took me out into the landscape to learn his trade.
One of the things we enjoy doing on the podcast is going behind the scenes and discovering more about what really happens on a time team dig, especially those ones from back in the day on Channel 4.
Yeah, Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor, has been giving me a wide-ranging interview about how the programme came to be, memorable moments, how Sir Tony Robinson ended up on the digs. But what we're about to talk about now is the bit he probably doesn't really want you to know about. What were some of the biggest challenges of making Time Team?
The problem with archaeology is you're also playing a bit of a game of poker. You have a site, you do the geophysics on the site, you've then got to make a decision about where you're going to stick the trenches. The problem is that if you put a trench in one place and there's nothing there, you can't just buzz off without digging it properly. Wherever you put a trench, you've got to do the proper archaeology. And in some cases, if you make the wrong choice, you use the wrong tactics, you get it wrong. We spectacularly did about 10 trenches and found absolutely nothing on one program. And that turned out to be one of our most popular programs, funnily enough. You know, it's Tony was walking around saying, well, you've finally done it, you've dug for 3 days and found absolutely nothing. And those are some of the challenges, apart from lots of other things like the weather, aggrieved farmers occasionally, bad-tempered landowners, that kind of thing. But that's all. Archaeologists have to put up with these things all the time.
And that relationship between the TV programme and the archaeologist, does that get strained? Because you talked about there the logistical challenges of will you actually be able to put another trench in because is there time and can you get it backfilled and all that kind of thing. But I imagine if I was an archaeologist and I was desperately going to do my research work there in the field, and then you're saying, hold on, because we need to get a camera in here and we need to film this, and can you just say that again and can you do that again? Do you two kind of ever rub each other up the wrong way?
Well, there's always a moment. Funnily enough, because the cameras just record what's there, we do ask them to repeat things, but not that often. But what does come into play is that if I've asked them to do a particular job, they need to take the time they need to do it. And I would say that a lot of the time I would be trying to slightly make them go faster. They're used to digging a thing in 3 years, and I'm asking them to do it in 3 days. And if it came to the crunch, I would go to Mick and say, what do you think? Do you think we can go faster? Do you think there is another trench? And if Mick said to me, no, I don't think so, I think we've got to go at this pace and I don't think we can have another trench, I would agree with him. Mick knew about television. Equally, he expected me to appreciate that he understood about archaeology. And between the two of us, I think we managed to balance that really well. And I would say that was, in many ways, the fundamental relationship on Time Team was when Mick and I got together and balanced out the needs of the archaeology against the needs of the television.
3 decades of Time Team then. What were some of your standout memories of that time in the trenches?
The easiest way for me is to hold it down to objects. Some of the things we found, we were digging a Viking site in the Isle of Man on a golf course. And the nice people at the golf course had decided to slightly sacrifice one of their sand traps because there was a keel there and there was lots of slate and lots of material there. And somebody said to Matt Williams, just keep checking this slate as it comes up because you never know. And lo and behold, one of the slates he pulled up had actually got Ogham writing. Sometimes it's called Futhark, but there was this scratched message from the past on this piece of stone. Helen rang a friend at Cambridge University who understood this and translated it. And it said something like 20 Vikings were cornered or quartered here. And as we began to peel these other slates back, lo and behold, there were burials there. And one of the burials was a woman, and her hair was perfectly preserved. I mean, this is setting aside the amazing sites like digging at Westminster Abbey in the grounds there, finding the earliest monks associated with the abbey, or digging Buckingham Palace, you know, some extraordinary places like that. But there's moments that occur when you think, my goodness, this is extraordinary. It was a burial, a Roman burial, and he was lying with his head turned to one side. And as Phil began to clean the area around the skull, he began to see Roman writing. And as we scraped down the stone, you could see Viridius written there. Viridius is a Roman god. And this person was buried in a Christian orientated burial, but with a head turned towards his favorite Roman god. So he was sort of hedging his bets on the afterlife, if you like. To see that writing appear, it was kind of like a message from the past. It was absolutely extraordinary.
Tim Taylor there. And the next time you hear from Tim, he'll be concluding the conversation by looking at how and why Time Team came to an end on Channel 4 and its rebirth online. But if you enjoy a trip down memory lane, though, and who doesn't, there's an enormous archive of Time Team episodes on our Time Team Classics YouTube channel, with episodes from Series 19 being added right now.
Yeah, definitely go and give them a watch if you possibly can. Okay, questions now then, and thank you very much if you've taken the time to send those in to us on Patreon. We've had so many, and they're all brilliant, so please do keep them coming in, because we need loads and we need some more for the next episode as well. You just go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial and it's all there for you. This one comes in from Philip Nelson, who says, hello, I love the podcast. Helen and Martin are great. Ooh, we've got very big heads now. My question is, where are all the plant pots? I've never heard someone say that's a bit of plant pot. It always seems to be cookware or tableware. Did they have indoor plants in the past? That is such a good question, Philip. And I will add to this, Helen, which is, why do people in the past seem to have been so obsessed with pottery? It always seems to be pottery. What is the answer then, Helen?
Well, the answer about the plant pots, well, first of all, that is a very great question, because, again, it's one of those questions that archaeologists don't often ask. They're used to what they have and they don't think, hang on, what about something that there isn't? It's much harder to find a gap than it is to explain something odd, to explain an odd positive. It's much harder to explain an odd negative. I started thinking about medieval plant pots, and I realised that there's a lot of pictures of the Virgin Mary when the angel Gabriel comes to tell her that about God's plan to for that she's going to have the baby Jesus. The pictures of the Virgin Mary and the angel Gabriel often have a lily in a pot between them. Now, that lily apparently symbolises the purity of Mary, but it's in a pot because it can't just be kind of hanging around and it's not growing in the earth. So they definitely knew of pots or vases. Now, some people do sometimes call it a vase, and I have to say we don't really know. So that was my first thought. Well, there is that lily in a pot. And then I went and looked this up, because I thought, well, yeah, that is such a good question. I have no idea what the answer is. And I found that we do have some medieval flower pots, and they're identified by having a hole in the base for drainage. We've also got ceramic watering cans. And so, Martin, that fits into your question about pottery. Why is there so much pottery? Because all our watering cans are plastic now, and they used to be metal. But back in medieval times, they had ceramic watering cans, and presumably that was because they had houseplants. Why else would you need a watering can? They do look a little bit like our current ones. They gently to drip the water in. Why they didn't just use jugs, I don't know, but they did have watering cans. Oh, and by the way, the reason there's so much pottery is that once you've made it and once you've broken it, there is just nothing you can do with it. You can't melt it down and use it again. And it never, ever biodegrades. It never rots away. It just keeps on accumulating more and more and more. And I think that's why there's so much in the soil. It's not so much that people used it more than anything else. It's that all of the wood you can't see and all of the metal got recycled. So pottery is literally rubbish. And that's why there's so much of it. So then I began thinking about indoor plants and light and whether a medieval house perhaps doesn't have the same amount of light as a later one. But of course, it would always have had windows and there would always have been somewhere to put your plants. But of course, windows didn't have glass in them so often in those days. So maybe it just wasn't as convenient to grow things on windowsills, because I expect we've all had that experience where you have a nice pot plant on the windowsill, you open the window, there's a gust of wind and the whole thing blows over. So it may just have been not quite so convenient in those days. And pot plants really get going in Georgian times with the rise of rich people living in lovely country houses, and they begin to appreciate the nature much more than they have in the past. Before the 18th century, nature is something to be kind of to escape from. You come into your nice warm house where the nasty cold outside weather and the wilderness and the wild animals are excluded. And then in the 18th century, you begin to appreciate the beauty of it. And maybe that's what starts us off with the flower pots. But this is all, you know, my comfort zone, which is after the Romans. And I thought perhaps I ought to get back to the Romans as well. And so I've had a little look at things like wall paintings from Pompeii and so on, looking to see if I can find flower pots. And essentially, I can't. And it is not at all easy. And then I began thinking, well, what about if it's just that they used any kind of pot? You might bore a hole in the base, maybe, but just like you can grow potatoes in a bucket, maybe they put their plants in any kind of pot that we might find and think, well, that would be cooking ware or a storage jar or tableware or whatever. But then I realised that, of course, if you've ever potted up or planted a seed in a classic storage jar with shoulders, you will know that that is a mistake, because if you try to take it out to repot it, it won't come out and you have to either dig it out in a horrible way or break the pot. You do need something special to be a flower pot, and we don't have them. Before, I mean, there's some really beautiful ones from Yorkshire, late medieval ones, but they think that was just one potter that was making them. They just didn't catch on for hundreds of years. So it's a really good question. And of course, to definitively answer it, you'd need somebody who knew more about pottery than me. But on a quick look round, trying to sort that out, I've just decided that that is a great question that needs more thought. So thank you, Philip.
Yeah, thank you very much, Philip. Right, question number two, and it comes from Mary Alice, who's in Raleigh in North Carolina. But I'm not going to read it out because Mary Alice is here to do it herself. Hi, Mary Alice.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for letting me be on the podcast.
Well, that's an absolute pleasure. It's really, really great to have you on. How old are you, may I ask, by the way, Mary Alice?
I'm 12.
12 years old. My understanding is that you are absolutely obsessed with archaeology. You love it so much. So what is it about archaeology that you like so much?
I like how wonderful it is that you can go really pretty much anywhere and find something. But you can't exactly find much here in the United States because, well, there isn't anything, or at least very little.
Yes, when you say you like archaeology because you can find it anywhere, that is such a good idea. And that's one of the things that I love about being able to share archaeology with people, because they can do a lot of it themselves by just going out for a walk and being observant. And that's easy for us to do perhaps in Britain, because so much of our archaeology is in our landscape, because our landscape we've been interacting with it and adapting it for thousands and thousands of years. But of course, America had this big disjuncture, didn't it? So you've got one group of people who've been interacting with the landscape in one way and perhaps quite a minimal way, and then all of a sudden Europeans come and suddenly do so many very big things like building roads and towns and so on, so that half the landscape isn't there because it's under a town, and the rest you have to look really, really hard. I have to say that I don't know very much about America, and I'm beginning to wonder whether we ought to get Stuart Ainsworth over there and see if we can do some American landscape archaeology. What do you think, Mary Alice?
I think that's awesome, except it's very, very hot.
Well, we've got used to some hotness. We know now that we need to spray each other down with water. And Kerry has a special thing. The pressure washer is sometimes used for. I'm sure this is terribly against health and safety, but occasionally we get the pressure washer out and squirt each other with it.
Okay, that is an integral part of archaeology, it turns out, Mary Ellis. You can write that down. So, what first got you interested in archaeology then?
My mom, she was the one who showed me Time Team first, and it just kept building, and we watched more and more, and we finally figured out, hey, they have a Patreon, woohoo! And so we subscribed to that, and it's a whole lot of fun to see new updates, and now my sisters are getting into it too, and we've dug a giant test pit in our backyard, which my dad is not exactly the happiest about.
We often find that the gardeners don't like it when we turn up and dig test pits. He's not alone. You can reassure him.
So what's your favourite period of history then that you've been learning about so far?
I like the Middle Ages the best, partly because most of my family history comes from the Middle Ages.
Tell us a bit more, because when I meet somebody new, I always look at their surname, because that often gets you right back centuries in a single leap. You can look at my surname and you know that if you look it up, you can discover that it comes from a small village in Cornwall, probably in the 16th century. So at least one of my lines of ancestry was in Cornwall in the 16th century. Do you know much about your family?
Not much, but my grandmother has traced us back all the way to Charlemagne.
Wow, that's fantastic.
That's so, so interesting, isn't it? Now, Mary Alice, I believe you have a question for us. What would you like to know?
How is the process of archaeology different in different places? For example, in England, probably every single shovel full of dirt has finds, whereas in America, there is practically nothing. How is the process of archaeology different in different parts of the world?
That's almost two questions in one, because the second bit you could answer in one way, and you might say, well, some countries, they have different protections on their archaeology and they have different ways of paying for it and they have different methods and so on and so forth. But the first part of your question is really interesting in that it relates to, it's why do some countries seem to have so much more material than other places. So if you go to somewhere like Spain or Italy, you can, and you go to a Roman site, you can be just falling over buildings and pottery and roof tile and so on. And you come back to Britain and you think, well, gosh, we are a damp outpost of the Roman Empire here. There's nothing to see. And maybe that was because people are so much poorer towards the edges of the empire that they didn't have enough resource to really be buying all that pottery and to be breaking it all. But the question about why some cultures have more than other cultures is a really big fundamental question in the whole of world archaeology. And sometimes it can be such a big question that we don't even start looking at it. And maybe it's being American and realizing there's a difference between Native American cultures and incoming Western cultures, that you see the difference and you need to explain it, whereas in Britain perhaps we don't. And that's where it's really valuable to talk to people from other countries. So I would say that it's because some cultures are richer, and if you're richer, not only do you have more, but you throw away more. You don't have to carefully look after things. And that's the reason, I think, that there's such a difference between the Roman period in Britain and the Anglo-Saxon period in England, because the Romans are creating a surplus from agriculture. So they're growing more than they need to eat. So they can use that surplus to buy things. Whereas once you move into the early Anglo-Saxon period, it becomes just subsistence archaeology. People are growing no more than they need. So they don't have so much stuff. this really needs a whole book, and I think it's quite well explained by Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs and Steel. Why does the West have more than the Southern Hemisphere? I don't think we put out reading lists, do we, Martin? But if we did, that would be a book I'd highly recommend.
We can, yeah.
It's very readable.
What do you think of that there, Mary Alice?
I like it. It definitely explains the question very well.
I would say so. And a brilliant question as well. Really, really good. Right then, we will leave you to it and say thank you very much for coming on and asking your question. What are you going to get back to doing now? How deep's this test pit?
At the moment, it's at least like half an inch. I hope we can make it a bit deeper.
Oh, okay. You've got some way to go.
It'll build your muscles up.
Keep going.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks, Mary Alice.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all the questions we've got time for on this episode, but there'll be more next time. So keep them coming in via Patreon. Just head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for that and loads more extra stuff from Time Team, including the full chat that we had with Professor Martin Carver at Sutton Hoo.
And that's the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for your company, and we'll speak to you next time on the Time Team podcast.